from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big open letter to Congress Monday from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Apparel and Footwear Association, the American Beverage Association, the American Forest and Paper Association, and 200-plus other of the country's biggest trade groups. Please don't shut down the government, they said. Please don't play chicken with the U.S. debt ceiling, with the U.S. economy. But here we are, this hour On Point, Washington's political upheaval and the country's economy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How's the pumped-up crisis in Washington look to you for the U.S. economy, for your personal economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to talk to a lot of people who are knee-deep, hip-deep, chin-deep in the economy in this hour. But first, for an update on the politics, joining us from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. She is deep in it herself. Nancy, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
You know, we're hearing all this back and forth now. Let's fund it a little at a time, Republicans say. Democrats say, no, we're not going to do that. What's the emerging sense of a timetable on this shutdown, Nancy? Does anybody have any idea if we're talking days or weeks or more?
The emerging sense, Tom, is that this could stretch on for weeks. I mean, you never know. Some resolution could present itself, but what that resolution would be right now is not apparent. There are no negotiations going on. And people are starting to think if this goes on any longer, you're really going to have two fights that get wrapped up into one. You know, we talked about how there would be this fight over funding the government, and then that would get wrapped up, and then we'd have a fight over raising the debt ceiling, which needs to be raised by mid-October. The Treasury Secretary hit that point again yesterday. Well, if this goes on a couple more days, what you're going to see is these two fights really have to bleed into one another. And then you get into perhaps even a bigger standoff, Republicans saying we want more in exchange for both funding the government and raising the debt ceiling. Democrats saying we're not going to give an inch. And then you have this standoff where Republicans feel, okay, we've gotten too far into this now. We can't back down gracefully without getting some major concessions. And Democrats saying, we think we have the high ground and we don't feel we have to negotiate.
Nancy, we've seen a faction in the Republican Party willing to absolutely go to the wall here and take the GOP with them on the shutdown. What about on the debt ceiling? Is there a faction that just doesn't buy that that's the third rail, that that's the thing that cannot be touched?
There are people who feel more afraid about going over the edge on the debt ceiling than they feel about the government shutdown. I talked to one Tea Party member yesterday, for example, who said, look, the government shut down, but here we are. The sun is still shining. The world didn't come to an end. So there's definitely a feeling that the stakes aren't as high for some of them with a shutdown as there is with the debt ceiling. But the problem is, either you go full on with this strategy or you don't. You either say, okay, here are our terms, here's what we want, and we're willing to hold up the debt ceiling because of it, or we're not willing to do that. So they can't sort of go halfway with this strategy, and I think that that's the challenge they find themselves in right now. They feel like, okay, we've put ourselves out there, we've come this far, we can't now walk away and say, well, the stakes are too high.
We're in no end in sight as of this moment, and you talk about October 17th with the debt ceiling, you get into weeks very quickly with all kinds of economic questions swirling around. Nancy Cordes with CBS News, you're the best. Thanks so much for joining us for a couple of minutes.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Lots of people talking about this. Here was the president yesterday in the Rose Garden saying Congress must act to prevent the U.S. economy from faltering.
If they go through with it this time and force the United States to default on its obligations for the first time in history, it'd be far more dangerous than a government shutdown, as bad as a shutdown is. It would be an economic shutdown.
An economic shutdown, people in the economy? Well, starting with government workers looking at this, many of them on furlough now, but right up to the top levels of American business, paying a lot of attention. Here was Honeywell CEO David Cote talking on Monday with Bloomberg Television's Trish Regan.
Uncertainty is a killer of economic growth. Economic growth is what we need for jobs. To the extent if A equals B, B equals C, then doing this sort of thing that adds to economic uncertainty causes all of us to say, Let's wait and see. There's no sense hiring. We don't know what those guys are going to do. And when you see the debt ceiling coming up right after this and the prospect of default, and you want to talk about creation of uncertainty, that would overturn over 200 years worth of history.
Honeywell CEO talking there with Bloomberg Television's Trish Regan, anchor for Bloomberg Television, host of Bloomberg's Daily Business Street Smart. Trish Regan joins us right now from New York. Trish, welcome back to One Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
How widespread is that kind of concern as you talk to people in business these days? We saw this big letter from the Chamber of Commerce and a couple of hundred other trade associations saying, don't do this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's happening so far. How widespread is the concern?
There is concern. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty right now as a result of Washington. And what Dave Cote, CEO of Honeywell, and others have made the point on is that it's very difficult to invest and to put capital to work when you do not know what is happening in Washington. And it's frustrating, I think, for a lot of CEOs to see this kind of dysfunction, because ultimately it does have an effect on the economy.
We've got big heads of the big banks in Washington today, at the White House today, mm-hmm. J.P. Morgan's chief, Jamie Dimon, Goldman Sachs folks, and others. What do you think they're saying to the president? Are they also talking with congressional leaders? What do you think their message is?
Oh, they sure are. I mean, their message is you guys need to get your act together, and you need to find a way to make sure that this shutdown doesn't go on too long. And more importantly, you've got to do something to make sure that we raise the debt ceiling before October 17th. I mean, that's the real Armageddon that everybody's watching here. I mean, the shutdown, we can manage. It's not great. And if you look at some of the economic impact, it just depends on how long it is, I should say. Mm-hmm. If it's 3-4 weeks, some economists predict it could shave 1.4 points off of GDP. But the real issue is the debt ceiling. And that's likely what they're talking to the president about today, because you just simply, as the United States of America, cannot, should not default on your debt. It's unlikely we will. One should anticipate that they'll get something done at the 11th hour. But having this kind of chaos running up to that deadline is just not good.
I'm reading here, this is a letter that went out to clients of Capital Economics. And there's they're advising investors, clients. This was at the end of last week. And they're writing here, they said, we have no idea exactly how this standoff will be resolved, and even less of an idea exactly when any agreement might be reached. And they said, at this stage, we would be lying if we said we were confident of a positive outcome. Now, the markets so far, they're down a little bit, but they look relatively calm about this. Is somebody somewhere watching and saying, oh, no, there we go. It's not going to be right. You know, bombs away, down go the markets.
Yeah, I think right now the market's in sort of a wait and see kind of mode. We saw a big sell off. Well, 100 and some odd points the day of the actual shutdown. And I think that people are looking and saying, okay, we'll give them a little time. It's October 2nd. We've got 15 days to get this thing worked out. As we get closer to that big day, you might start to see more anxiety in the markets. But right now, people are hopeful that they actually will get something done at the 11th hour. We'll see. I mean, it will, as we get closer to that deadline, create more uncertainty. The markets hate uncertainty. I spoke yesterday with Professor Jeremy Siegel from the Wharton School of Business.
Sure.
And he actually said, look, if they can get the debt ceiling raised in time, I think it's going to add another 1,000 points to the Dow before year end. What we're seeing right now is this uncertainty is holding investors back a little bit. Once you get that out of the way, there's no reason why we shouldn't move a lot higher.
We heard so much about uncertainty in the economy from Republicans over the last couple of years. But roll the tape back a little, Trish. Before all of this crisis surged to the fore in the last few weeks here, it seemed to me the economy, this recovery, anything but stellar, but there's a kind of emerging story that, you know what, American fundamentals are not so bad. And if we play our cards right, we could actually be headed into a good era for the U.S. economy. Were you hearing that over the summer?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentals are not that bad. They're also not that great,
yep.
Tom. I mean, 2.5% growth, sure, we'll take it. It's better than nothing. But if you look historically at any other recession we've ever gone through, you tend to see a big bump up. There's been a lot of pent-up demand, and it results in a much bigger increase in GDP. We're not getting those big increases in GDP, in part because we're also going through somewhat of a systemic or significant change, one could say, in the overall economy. So jobs, well-paying jobs, are much harder to come by for your average American. We've gone through a massive transition where a lot of those factory jobs are no longer there. And people are trying to be retrained in different services jobs, and some of them just don't pay as well. So that's part of what's going on. And I think a lot of people are just still so scared from everything that happened. And here we are this many years later, and people still feel the effects of 2008.
You know, the GOP for forever seen as a good friend to business. What about the Tea Party faction now? Do big business folks look across at the Tea Party and say, well, in the end, we can deal with them, or they're not so sure?
I think a lot of people feel like the Tea Party has effectively held the Republican Party hostage. You know, Senator John McCain was on my program on Monday and was making the point that, you know, look, Obamacare, you may not like it, but it got written into law, and this is not the proper way to go about changing it. We have a democracy here, so the answer is you go out and you run based on the idea that you are going to change this, and you do this in the proper legislative and electoral way. You don't go out and try and do this at the 11th hour and force a government shutdown. So I think there's a lot of people in the business community that may feel similar.
Watch out how you handle the nation's business. Trish Regan with Bloomberg Television's daily business show, Street Smart. It's always great to have you right here, Trish. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the shutdown, the debt ceiling, Washington's big game of chicken, and the U.S. economy. What's at stake for the economy and Washington's wild politics these days? Different views already in Washington of what we see out there. Here was Republican Congresswoman from Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn, talking with Fox News yesterday.
I think that you may see a partial shutdown for several days, but people are probably going to realize they can live with a lot less government than what they thought they needed.
Yeah, we can bounce along here. Different view from the Democratic side of the aisle. Here was Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren on the Senate floor Monday, emphasizing the economic context of Republican efforts to defund the Affordable Care Act.
With millions of people out of work, with an economic recovery still far too fragile, with students and families being crushed by student loan debt, with millions of seniors denied their chance at one hot meal a day with Meals on Wheels, and millions of little children pushed out of Head Start because of a sequester, with the country hours away from a government shutdown and days away from a potential default on the nation's debt.
A much darker view of the context for all this action in Washington, and that's before we get to the debt ceiling. I want to turn right now to Washington and Justin Wolfers. He's a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan, senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. Justin Wolfers, thanks for joining us.
Tom, a pleasure to be here.
What do you see as the economic stakes in the political conflict that we see now in Washington?
So I think most economists think that the government shutdown is not of, in and of itself, a major economic threat, or at least it's not if it's fairly short run. Looking forward, if we keep the government shut down for several weeks, you could see that undermining confidence. The real fears, though, are if this extends into the debt ceiling and we see the same sort of intransigence that we've seen over the government shutdown leading to the debt ceiling being breached, then the forecasts from my friends range from terrible to truly dreadful.
I mean, what does that mean when you and your economist friends say terrible and truly dreadful?
So there's two ways of thinking about what a debt ceiling breach would do. So the first thing is, if the US government can't borrow any more money, that means that the amount we spend has to be equal to the amount that's coming in. That would amount to a tightening of fiscal policy of around about 4% of GDP, and it would happen overnight. That's almost an unprecedented tightening of fiscal policy, and just by itself, that would be enough to cause a recession. And the only question is how deep that would be. The second channel, though, is potentially the one that scares people more, but we know less about, which is if the U.S. government goes into default, U.S. government debt is actually used as collateral throughout the financial system. Now, if that collateral is not available, then the whole system could seize up. It's a similar dynamic to that we saw in the 2008 financial crisis, which is I'm unwilling to do business with you because I don't know what's on your books and I fear that you've got a bunch of bad debt running around. Except this time the bad debt's not mortgage-backed securities, it would be government debt.
So when you look back to 2007, 2008, there you're talking about that kind of potential market collapse. I don't know what.
I guess we call it the market freezing up, which is no one's in a position to do business with anyone else because no one knows if anyone else is holding good debt or bad debt. I should be clear. The first channel that I talked about, which is an immediate huge fiscal contraction, we know a lot about what that would look like. Mm-hmm. It's enough for a recession. This financial stuff, we really don't. And it could be that the financial system handles it pretty well and we just shrug and move on. But it could be catastrophic. And the truth is, we economists have no idea where it is on that spectrum.
Well, how much give can you imagine there is in the system? I mean, let's say, you know, we're in territory that we've not been in many ways in exactly this way before. If we get into testing the debt ceiling breach, let's say we breach it for 24 hours or for 2 days. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine a couple of weeks from now or more, you know, all-night negotiations going on and on and on. But does it take a one-minute breach for things to, you know, for stock markets around the world to go kabloom? Or is there enough give in the system that they could say, oh, that's just those crazy Americans, let's humor them for a couple of days? What do you think?
Yeah, so this is a good point. There really are two types of breaches we could have. There'd be a very short-term, what I guess we call a technical default, where, you know, Congress figures it out within the next day or two. And if that happens, then we don't – then, you know, some payments don't quite get made on time to, you know, yours and my grandparents on Social Security. But then the only channel we need to worry about is the financial channel. There wouldn't be, you know, a huge immediate lasting fiscal contraction. And there, I think you've painted the two ends of the spectrum, which is, in reality, bondholders are going to get paid. They're probably going to get paid pretty soon. So you'd really think the whole financial system, everyone should be able to shrug and just get on with business. But that, of course, isn't the reality of how the contracts are written or of how markets actually operate. And the question is, if U.S. government debt is no longer – which the whole system is built on this edifice of assuming it's risk-free. Hmm. And if all of a sudden we learn that there is actually some risk to it, then will that cause all lending throughout the system to start to seize up? And that is a real possibility.
As you say, we don't know because this is uncharted territory. There's never been in our couple of centuries plus of U.S. history a debt ceiling breach or a breach on the U.S. full faith and credit.
We've actually defaulted twice before.
Oh.
Once was well over a century ago. And okay. So that's even for the old folks, that's too long
ago. Okay.
But there was basically a computer glitch a couple of decades ago. Which meant purely technical default, just the checks didn't quite go out on time. That was actually enough that bond markets raised the yields, so they raised the interest rates they charged the U.S. government to borrow by quite a substantial amount. So it didn't cause the system to seize up, but it actually had a long-lasting and quite expensive effect, which is it becomes more expensive for the U.S. government to borrow.
And then, of course, people really dug in on all sides at this point. Republicans saying we are not going to stop here until we get what we're asking for on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. The president saying again yesterday in the Rose Garden he's not going to negotiate over the debt ceiling. This time it's enough with all that. Here's the president.
I will not negotiate over Congress's responsibility to pay bills it's already racked up. I'm not going to allow anybody to drag the good name of the United States of America through the mud just to refight a settled election or extract ideological demands. Nobody gets to hurt our economy and millions of hardworking families over a law you don't like.
Won't negotiate, but we're already over one cliff, shut down, and headed for another, much steeper one, people say, on the debt ceiling. Justin Wolfer is Please Stand By in Washington. With us right now from Chicago is Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, Chicago-based financial services firm. She served for a couple of terms in the Congressional Budget Office's panel of economic advisors, got a sense of the economy and Washington politics. Diane Swonk, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Good to be here, Tom.
So there's the president. He says he won't negotiate. The top line still out of the GOP these days with the Tea Party, you know, on the steering wheel is they won't negotiate, or at least they've got non-negotiable demands. Where does this point us economically, Diane?
Well, you know, the real issue is, and I think Justin made a very good point, we don't want a self-induced financial crisis, which is a potential as we breach the debt ceiling. But the real potential is instead of this shutdown being instead of a debt ceiling showdown, it's now a prelude to a much stronger showdown over the debt ceiling. And we could actually see the government shut down right up until the 11th hour and negotiations over the debt ceiling fail, and then something like the president coming in and having to use executive order to raise the debt limit, which I think he would do, that would then trigger a whole constitutional issue and constitutional crisis and a rush of litigation. So any way you cut this, it's very difficult to get out of those uncertainties in Washington. But I think the important issue is as this lasts on and as the showdown starts to intensify, we're already starting to see the collateral damage in financial markets. For instance, Treasury bills that are expected to be redeemed right after October 17th got a premium priced into them yesterday. That's very important because they're already starting to financial markets who, you know, literally turn a deaf ear to Capitol Hill are starting to say, well, just as an insurance policy, maybe we should price a little more risk in. And that gets to the higher interest rate issue that Justin mentioned. And the costs imposed on the economy accumulate and cascade over the weeks as the government is shut down as well. We also don't know if these 800,000 workers that have been put on furlough, unlike previous shutdowns, they're not being guaranteed that they'll be paid retroactively, which is another hit to income in the fourth quarter, critical holiday season, and compounding uncertainty. Hesitation in the context of the current economy, which has already been a subpar recovery, means, you know, less job hiring and less spending. And that's just something we don't need. We could actually see a stall rate even if we avert what Justin very eloquently pointed out, you know, in terms of the self-induced financial crisis.
I mean, you've written a recession may be averted as long as we lift the debt ceiling. It's already a big question mark over this economy with all this swirling around, Diane.
Exactly. And the issue is that, you know, the fiscal crisis, you know, the fiscal crunch is already pretty strong. And many people don't realize that the 2014 sequestration will go back into effect. That's not been dealt with yet. So that's an even bigger drag on the economy still coming up. And fiscal drag is going to be a issue for some time to come. The problem is much of the cuts we're seeing in the government spending today don't do anything to get us out of rising deficits in the future, the deficits falling today, because of our aging population. They don't deal with the structural problems of the fact that we don't have enough money coming in to pay for the promises we've made to the elderly, to some young people, people on disabilities, Medicare, Medicaid. And that's very important, is that, you know, we're taking these cuts and taking the pain at a time when the economy certainly doesn't need it, without any progress on fiscal sustainability.
Talk about uncertainty around the economy. There it is right there. Diane Swonk, Justin Wolfers, please stand by. Let's bring some listeners in. Stillwater, Oklahoma. Jeff is calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine. What do you see, Jeff?
Well, I just wanted to give a quick viewpoint, probably from the middle, and to address the earlier questions about the economy and whether it's recovering. I don't really think it is for the people right in the middle. I think we're being overly taxed to pay for a lot of programs we don't support, whether it's wars we really don't need, or a lot of social programs we could probably administer much better at local and state levels. And, of course, on the other end, I think, you know, big companies are gaining quite a bit from, you know, the stock market, but that's just really being artificially supported by the Federal Reserve policies.
So you're sitting in the middle and not feeling much love already at this point, Jeff.
Absolutely. Now, I don't think anybody, by the way, I'm not a supporter of the Democrats. I'm not a supporter of Republicans, and I don't think anybody supports anything like a shutdown. But on the other hand, when I hear people feeling sorry for the government because they can't continue to borrow money, it's laughable. I mean, they, you know, our government needs to be put under control, and I think that is the impetus of the Tea Party.
What about when the president says, hey, Congress, you already spent this money, so, you know, pay the bills that you've racked up, Congress? Does that argument cut ice with you, Jeff?
Well, I don't think it cuts ice with the people that are in Congress right now. I think maybe the people that voted for it 2 years ago, there was a majority of the people that had to have, you know, stood by what they voted for 2 years ago. I think with the new people in there now, no, I don't think they support it.
Yeah, no, we can certainly see resistance right there. Jeff in Stillwater, Oklahoma, thanks very much for your call. Justin Wolfers, speak to that sort of man in the middle there. There's Jeff, you know, feels like he's kind of middle class, whatever that means in this country anymore, watching all this go on, and that nobody's looking out for his interests.
So the data actually bears out some of Jeff's concerns. It turns out that the recovery, as weak as it's been, has been even weaker for the middle class. And actually, average rates of economic growth for the middle class have been around about 0.5 percentage point, so barely anything at all. I think the real concern for, if not Jeff, then certainly I bet he has friends and colleagues, is unemployment, which is obviously a devastating blow for lots of people. For me as a professional economist, the most disappointing thing is we think we know a fair few things about how to get out of a recession or a slow recovery. There's not a single textbook you can find anywhere that says in the middle of a faltering recovery, shut down the government, maximize uncertainty, and threaten to default on your bills. This is flat-out economic sabotage, and it's the same thing that happened in 2011. And the thing is, there's not a single economist in the United States who'll stand up for it.
I mean, Diane, when you've got the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has been very famously and very prominently very conservative on lots of issues recently, and then 200-plus other trade associations writing a letter to Congress saying, please, please, please don't do this, why doesn't that cut any mustard these days? I mean, it's happening anyway. Where's the weight of that business voice at this moment?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. We actually saw the Business Roundtable, which is also one of the most influential lobbyist groups in Washington, which, to the chagrin of some people, they don't always like that. The big business has this huge influence in Washington, but yet they don't. And I think that really shows that there are some in Congress, and I agree 100% with Justin, that this is complete economic sabotage. You know, dealing with the government and our ideological issues that we have to sort out as a nation about the size, that's one issue. But to do it in this context is not at all acceptable, because it will just hurt those very people, like the one you just had on the phone. So, but the real issue is you're going to see a lot more lobbying money poured into Washington over the next several weeks. But it's not clear that the people who control the vote at this point in time, which are not all of one party or another, are actually listening to or are being swayed by that money. It's people who are actually more moderate that are being swayed by that money in both sides of the party, and more of the people in the middle that are being swayed, which is kind of interesting that we're seeing sort of a deaf ear turned towards the lobbyists, which I don't always mind happening.
Yeah, yeah.
At this point in time, I kind of want those lobbyists to have a say, because this is our economy. It's everybody's economy. And the middle class has been hit hard. So as I really want to echo something Justin said, the cost for an economist of long-term unemployment, this is the longest time we've had this high of a percentage of people unemployed for a very long period of time, the loss of human capital there, they accumulate and they cross generations. We know that fathers that have unemployed more than a year from the 1980 studies and now from today, their sons in particular seem to do much worse than their cohorts who stay employed. And that's just something not acceptable for our future.
Diane, when you say this is economic sabotage, in this context that we're living in right now, what are you pointing to exactly? What's the sabotage?
Well, the loss of actual spending, the government, the loss of incomes, the loss of spending at the stage of the game, the addition of uncertainty in a period that's already been very uncertain. The caller was very right. Corporate America has recovered. We've seen enormous recovery in corporate profits, and that's part of the reason the stock market has gone up. Also, the Fed has helped. That's one of the places they have influence on. But I think it's important to understand that, you know, part of the reason we haven't seen the money on corporate balance sheets turned into investments more in our future is because of the uncertainty and the lumpiness of growth. It's not been, you know, consistently strong economy, and there's been these constant headwinds and policy uncertainty have been one issue, and they're amplified. They're noise in an economy spinning at 4 or 5% in a recovery, but they have a lot of sound, and they're amplified in an economy that's growing closer to 2 or less, which is the third quarter, and it looks like it's going to be the fourth quarter as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the shutdown, the debt ceiling, Washington's big game of chicken, and the U.S. economy. What's at stake for the economy in Washington's wild politics right now and in the weeks and maybe months ahead? Diane Swonk is with us from Chicago, chief economist at Mesirow Financial there. Justin Wolfers of University of Michigan is here, also senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, with us today from Washington. Diane, Justin, lots of response online here. Dave says, I think we're seeing what happens when a suicide bomber reaches elective office. Okay. The Coast says it's quoting Senator Barack Obama from 2006. Now, I can't exactly verify this, but it looks right to me, quoting the senator, then Senator Obama, saying, "I therefore intend to oppose efforts to increase America's debt limit." Him opposed back in the day. William says, so big business is worried that their sugar daddy, big government, might not be passing out the billions to them. Yeah, let's line up with those guys. Not so ready to weep for the big trade associations, but that's a lot of the economy they represent too. And Aviva says, of course, they're completely screwing our economy and they don't care because somehow they think it's going to backfire on Obama. I don't know, Diane. What about the? I mean, there is people are playing with fire here. There's a blame game already out there. Everybody trying to hoist it onto everybody else. What's your experience tell you about where blame falls if we do, you know, come crashing down in the midst of all this gamesmanship?
Well, first of all, blood is on everyone's hands. That's all there is to it. I mean, Washington's failed us. Period. And I think that's important. The second issue, I think, is let's get some history on the debt ceiling here, because I think it's really important to understand that, yes, it has been used as a tool to object to things in the past, and it has been unfairly used, and I don't think, unfortunately, it was raised the most times actually during the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, but it has been used as a tool by both Democrats and Republicans alike to protest, but they did it in the context of knowing they would never actually breach it. And I don't think that's right. But let's go back to the history of what the debt ceiling really is. It was actually invoked during, it was developed during the World War I, so that then-President Wilson could go beyond what Congress had approved and issue war bonds. So it was actually initially designed to give the president some flexibility, and it's kind of an archaic remnant of that period, to issue more war bonds above and beyond what Congress had approved in a time of war. And so it's being used as a political basketball when it had never been intended that way. And frankly, there's only a few other countries, I think Australia and Denmark, that have debt ceilings, and it's because they're very dysfunctional when they get into used as this political, you know, sort of hockey puck or something like that, which has been used by both sides. And yes, Barack Obama did actually vote against the debt ceiling increase, say he would vote against it back when he was a senator, because he opposed what was going on with at that point in time. And so I think we have to acknowledge, you know, that there is blood on everyone's hands here, and unfortunately this thing that was not an ever intended for these purposes has taken on a political life of its own that's now far beyond, you know, anything that we should be doing. And I think I'm sort of more sympathetic with the suicide bombers there. And big business, you know, I understand people don't like this, that big business has such an influence in Washington, but the reality is they do employ a lot of people, and the ripple effects for the economy are there, and you got to acknowledge that. And, you know, this is costing all of us. This is not something that, you know, like it or not, whether they're championing this or not, we all should be concerned about the economy. I'm most concerned about the middle class and the lowest income of individuals, because they're getting hit the hardest by that. Those who have the least to lose are losing the most.
I don't know if there's going to be equivalency seen here. Justin Wolfers, have you ever seen the debt ceiling used as leverage in the way we've seen in the last year and a half here, last winter when the GOP pushed hard on it, this time when we may do it again? Is that traditional kind of leaning on that debt ceiling, or are we in new territory here?
We're in entirely new territory, or to the extent that we're not, it's that we went through this whole escapade in 2011, and it nearly choked off the recovery back then, and it may well do the same again now. Look, Tom, I think it's worth, I want to emphasize and build on something Diane was just saying. People do have an innate sympathy for the debt ceiling, and that's because they think of it as if it were the debt limit on their credit card, and having a debt limit on the credit card makes a lot of sense to a lot of people.
Live within your means, yeah.
But that's not what the debt ceiling is. If you refuse to pass this, in fact, what you're saying is you're refusing to allow the president to pay the bills that he's already run up and that Congress has already passed. So this is, in fact, a law that's not you need to have a limit on your credit card. It is you need to stiff the credit card company.
This is blowing off visas. Forget
Stop
about it.
Sending in your payments.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go to Doug in Atlanta, Illinois. Doug, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
What do you know, Doug?
My point was, is I am also a federal worker, and it's kind of a unique situation. I work for the United States Census Bureau, and the Census Bureau are the people who gather the information to give you the unemployment rate, and now we are going to be unemployed and going to the unemployment office, and that's going to be a segment of the society that's not even going to be recognized because hopefully we go back to work and we're no longer going to be unemployed, but the unemployment rate run up while we're gone.
Yeah.
And all the work that we do during that time, which is the unemployment rate, to gather information for the consumer price index, all that type of stuff work is not going to be done.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Doug, I appreciate your call. Good luck on furlough there. Diane, I mean, we may not even know exactly what's happening with some of these federal data gatherers off the clock.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I mean, really, it gets to, you know, I mean, people say, we don't like government. Well, there are some things that are public goods. Do they not like, you know, having their Social Security or Medicare, or do they not like having somebody who has to process those checks? But more importantly, the transparency. Capitalism is founded on the fact of being able to see something out there, to be having to have some vision or some view. And the data is really important in that process. And, you know, we have a lot of people in census, a lot of people in the statistical agencies. In fact, a friend of mine at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, there's four people there. They put together the GDP data. Four people, the IT person, two security guards, and him. That's it. Nobody else. They've shut down. And, you know, the issue is not only will we not have the clarity of the data, like the employment report or the unemployment report, we won't have – that will compound our issue of uncertainty right now, and certainly for financial markets. It also is something that's really valuable for people to be able to gauge, you know, where we are in the recovery. And I think this is very important. I also am very concerned that it's not just the employment report that may or may not be released on Friday. They haven't decided that for sure yet, although it doesn't look like it's going to be released. But it also affects the Federal Reserve as well. And people may not like what the Fed is doing now, but they're adhering to a mandate that says we need to do something if the economy has inflation too low or unemployment too high. And both of those things are in violation now. And the Fed is attempting to do something. We can all debate whether it's effective or not. But at the end of the day, you now have also no means to base that policy on.
Justin, with all of our issues and problems, the U.S. has done well in some ways in recent years because the rest of the world could look a little more uncertain sometimes. And money, capital would come here for security. Do we put that at risk with this? I've seen TV reports from around the world where people are just sort of slack-jawed, rolling their eyes at the United States these days and what we're up to.
It's fascinating to read the overseas reports about the current standoff, and it does show a country that's currently unable to govern itself. And this is a country that prides itself on being the engine of the world's economy. Were I an overseas investor looking to invest, I wouldn't want to invest in a country where I thought they didn't have the capacity to solve their economic problems. And it may be that much of the time gridlock's a good thing. It keeps government out of the way. It may not be, of course, but it may be that. But then there are important times, like in the wake of the financial crisis, when the government's just got to get things done. And they can't even pass a budget. They can't even guarantee that they're going to pay their bills. It leads one to think that this is a country that really risks not being able to govern itself.
Justin Wolfers, Diane Swank, let me take this very local, if I may. Joining us right now from Fort Mitchell, Kentucky, is Steve Stevens. He is president and CEO of the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce. That's kind of in the greater Cincinnati area there. Steve Stevens, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
How's all this filtering down to you and your member businesses there? Do they have a sense that, Congress is up to some hijinks, but we'll be fine? Or are they worried that this could turn over the apple cart?
Well, I do want to say that this is a very fragile economy locally as well as nationally as we view it. And we've been very encouraged. We've seen manufacturing coming back.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, larger companies like that drive small business growth to an extent. And so small businesses are still cautious. You know, they're trying to grow. We want them to grow. We want them to invest in people and in their capital, et cetera. But let me tell you a real localized way this really hurt us. We also have an IRS facility here that has 4,000 employees.
Big one, wow.
In Covington, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right on the river, across the river from Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, 3,000 of them did not go to work.
Wow.
And when they did not go to work, that meant that restaurants, retail establishments, et cetera, that were all in that general vicinity, didn't have very many people in them, you know, when it was time for lunch or other times of the day. So there is a very big ripple effect that occurs by virtue of that type of shutdown.
I don't know your political district that well, Steve. Are you one of these sort of solid Tea Party districts, that goes very reliably for that kind of a representative in Congress? Or is it more, you know, it could go either way, either party? What are the politics there?
Well, it has shifted over the years, and yes, it is very conservative, and there is a large Tea Party presence here. You know, we do have a Republican congressman, and we have two Republican senators in Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul.
So how do you think that's going to play? I mean, if this is shaking up your local economy, will it shake up the politics, or people are just stone cold behind that Tea Party perspective wherever it takes the economy? Or are people grumbling and saying, wait a minute, I don't know about this?
Well, I think they have become very conservative, and they are very principled, and they feel strong about their principles.
Yep.
But I think after a while, that kind of can wear thin, especially when people aren't, you know, working and their jobs are kind of going away. You know, when you look at the economy and you say small businesses represent about 60 to 80% of net new jobs annually, and we're sort of sitting at a very stalled period right now, after a while, I think people will grumble loudly.
Are you worried that Congress could take this all the way into the debt ceiling and the whole sort of everything on the line scenario, Steve?
Well, it's definitely looking like a bit of a showdown, and that does worry me. You know, we've seen, you know, folks do a bit of, you know, staring each other down, mm-hmm. and then eventually somebody blinks and we move forward. That's where I think we all hope it ends up going sooner than later. But, you know, a protracted stalemate here, I think, is really going to affect our entities here, because we need folks investing, you know, and the fact that, you know, we won't be able to process any new SBA loans, you know, going forward.
Small Business Administration, yeah.
Small Business Administration loans that people need to invest in capital, then, of course, and can put on workers. I mean, our unemployment rate is falling. But let me give you another example. Finally, we've seen a recovery in our home building industry here. And we just saw a report recently that we're up 20% in home sales in the region, which is fantastic. And so often they have helped lead us out of some of our recessionary periods. Well, all of a sudden then there's no access to FHA loans, which then has a very big impact on that economy. And that represents a large number of employees across this region.
They're right from northern Kentucky. It's not at all hypothetical what we're seeing already around the economy with this shutdown. Let's take a call from Bill in Richmond, Vermont. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and guests. My question is pretty straightforward and simple. What can we as Americans do to force Congress to break this gridlock? They seem to be staring each other down, or trying to, but ignoring what increasingly I feel, and I think many others feel, is America is a concern among the population in America that they're going to bring this economy back to its knees.
Yeah.
Do we need to march on Washington, and do we need to put a million people in Washington, D.C., gridlock the city?
Yeah, well, gridlock on gridlock, I don't know. But, Bill, these stakes are no joke, and Americans have been through a lot already. I mean, Steve, I don't expect you to have the full answer to that, but what are you doing to try and encourage the resolution of this? You're head of the Chamber of Commerce there.
Well, I think you have to put faces of real people, real businesses, in front of those who are in the position to make a change and to affect the change, and to really, really kind of paint the picture for them at the local level. You know, the old adage that all politics are local really does play out here. And I think, you know, real business people have to sit down and talk about it. You know, we want in this region a new bridge across the Ohio River between Kentucky and Ohio. It's going to cost us $2.8 billion to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized a while ago that the only way we could do that is to come together as two states, two business communities, to sets of government officials and figure this out. And we've been moving forward, and albeit the fact is it's a slow process, I think we're getting somewhere, and that's what Congress has to do.
Is your
Congress
Tea Party rep ready to hear that, Steve? Say, oh, okay, Steve, you know, yes, we've had a point to make, but we want to be real. We're ready to we hear your concern. We're going to simmer down, or not.
Well, I guess that just remains to be seen, Tom. I hope that, you know, smart heads will prevail here and understand what the right thing to do is for this this region and then the entire economy. I don't think you can watch businesses sort of wither away and die. And those folks are your constituents, and they're gonna tell you about it.
Steve Stevens, President and CEO of the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce. Steve, you're great. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Diane Swonk, sitting there in Chicago, you must be listening closely to that. I mean, there's a firsthand report right from the real front of the economy.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think what's interesting here is, you know, we're hearing this sort of tone deafness in Capitol Hill, but the reality is they do listen to constituents, and over time it really is important to make your voice be heard. Send a letter, send an email, call up your representative. That's really important to do in the context of this environment and say what you want them to do and what you don't want them to do. I think that's very important. The other issue is vote in the primaries. One of the problems with our system now is that very few people vote the primary, so a very minority of people determine the outcome for both parties of who's going to run in the general elections, and that has limited the choice of people, and it's also now limiting the quality of people who are willing to run. And I think that's very important as well, is that, you know, vote, get out there and vote in the primaries so that we can avoid some of this sort of disconnect going forward.
There's some answer for you, Bill, in Richmond, Vermont. I don't know about a march, maybe. But countervailing pressure from voters all over does have an effect over time. Diane Swonk with Mesirow Financial in Chicago, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Justin Wolfers, University of Michigan, thanks to you.
Always good fun.
Tomorrow on this hour, Thomas Friedman on gerrymandering and shutdown. This is On Point.